Hello, and welcome to the Transfer Window Podcast, where we take you inside the big stories at the biggest clubs in world football, and also provide you with expert analysis, insight on the issues affecting the game. I'm Ian McGarry, and joining me is regular pundit extraordinaire Duncan Castles. And I'm delighted to say that we've been also joined by an old friend of the Transfer Window podcast, Mr. Liam Rossignol, ex-professional footballer and now UEFA Pro Licence coach, who's assistant to the under-23s at Brighton. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
We're going to kick off with some news, as we like to do on the podcast, as all our listeners know, and that's to do with the upholding of Chelsea's transfer window ban for the transgression of rules on the recruitment of under-18s from abroad. I'm sure most of you will know FIFA rejected Chelsea's appeal to them. Chelsea have now appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne with regard to trying to have the ban suspended or lifted. But at this moment in time, they are not allowed to sign players in the transfer window this summer and then the following window in January 2020. Duncan, were you surprised that FIFA upheld their own ruling? And do you think this will mean massive trouble for Chelsea with regards to players leaving? Because I think we should emphasise that although Chelsea are not allowed to sign players, players are allowed to leave.
I wasn't surprised at all that FIFA upheld the ban. You only have to look at the details of what Chelsea have been sanctioned for. So there was 29 separate cases of recruiting players under the age of 18 against long-standing FIFA transfer rules. If you read around the story, you'll find that they've gone to very extensive lengths to recruit these underage players in terms of money promised to the players themselves, agents, their parents, setting up teams to play outside the normal youth league structure so that they could field effectively a team with multiple illegally signed players in it and have them in a kind of shadow development program at the club until they were formally allowed to play them in the Premier League and the UEFA's youth leagues. So the evidence against them is extremely strong, clear cut. It's something Chelsea have been doing for years and years and years. They've had problems on this underage recruitment issue in the past and managed to get out of them by essentially paying off the club that they'd acquired a player illegally from, Gal Kakuta being an example here. FIFA had such a strong case. Chelsea appealed it as they had to appeal to FIFA. I think although the club will say and have said that they disagree with everything in FIFA's ruling, their expectation was that FIFA were going to turn down their appeal and that would then get them to go to the next stage, which was to go outside FIFA and go to the Court of Arbitration and Sport and appeal against the ruling. And I think what Chelsea are trying to do with that Court of Arbitration and Sport appeal is obviously they'd like to win it, but I think they're realistic and they will realise the chances of winning it are low given the history of other clubs who have broken these rules and been successfully sanctioned by FIFA, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Barcelona. But the hope would be that because it goes to the Court of Arbitration of Sport at this stage of the season with the transfer window just about to open, that the court, that CAS would suspend the ban while they looked at the case, allowing Chelsea to make transfers this summer. And then once CAS made a decision, then the ban would probably be for the January window and the following summer window. That's happened before. From what I understand, FIFA are petitioning CAS very hard to ensure that doesn't happen in this case and will use the gravity of the transgressions and the number of transgressions as an argument to say that CAS should not allow Chelsea to have a suspended ban in this window and that the ban will be in place and therefore Chelsea will have to take major steps in terms of the recruitment decisions about the huge number of players they have on ownership of and on loan at other clubs to build their squad for next season without being able to buy new players.
And of course, this comes against the bigger backdrop, Duncan, of what we've seen as we could describe as the almost disinterest, ennui of Roman Abramovich in the club now, since, of course, the visa issue of last year. There's been speculation for months now that he would sell the club. I've spoken to people in football finance who have told me that with a statute ban in place, which can improve the squad, the value of the club could decrease as much as 15% in that period. Do you think that would make it more attractive to potential buyers? And are we possibly seeing the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire?
I'm not sure the transfer window ban makes that much of a difference to the sale of the club. This is a decision for Roman Abramovich. He is clearly unhappy with how things have been at Chelsea. He's very unhappy with his treatment by the UK government in terms of having his visa to live in the UK removed. And we saw immediately after that decision was taken that he cancelled the huge rebuilding plans in place for Stamford Bridge, into which he'd, or the club, had invested a huge amount of money. Every time Chelsea are asked about this, and Roman Abramovich, which is people are asked about it, they say he does not intend to sell the club. Nothing on record from Roman Abramovich, of course, or from his representatives. But if you talk to people who are interested in buying the club and people who are involved in the sale of football clubs, it is very much an open secret, or that the club is available for sale, that there are investors looking at it, and that some of those investors have started to do due diligence on the purchase. I think that's the bigger hurdle in terms of the sale of Chelsea. I've been briefed by someone close to one of the investors interested in taking over the club, and he said the complication is that most of Abramovich's money that was invested into Chelsea is still owed against the football club in the form of debts held by the club's parent company. So essentially the club is about, figure off the top of my head here, it's about £1 billion in debt to Abramovich. Now, if you buy that, you have to take on those debts and cancel those debts. Those debts are held in offshore trusts. It's a very shadowy ownership structure. So in a due diligence process, the people have to be very careful to find out exactly what they're buying, what liabilities they're buying, and what the actual ownership structure of the club is hidden behind these offshore trusts before they commit to a purchase. And I think, from what I'm hearing from people involved in this, that's the bigger hurdle rather than any sort of damage, short-term damage, not being able to work in the transfer window would do to Chelsea. Because they are, I mean, let's face it, they've secured the Champions League qualification for next season. So that guarantees them a large amount of extra revenue and increases their attractiveness to buyer, even if they're purchasing something which is not in the best of situations at present.
Well, it's been a monumental week for English football in Europe. We had games on Tuesday and Wednesday, which many people described as unbelievable. In fact, I think I heard one interview with one manager where unbelievable was mentioned 11 times this week. So I think we can certainly agree that that's the case. But the dust's settling a little bit now. Liam, I'm intrigued to get your thoughts as a coach on what Maurizio Pochettino did to turn the game on Wednesday night against Ajax round. Because remember, they were 2-0 down at halftime and looked like it was all over. What did you make of the substitution they made? And then, of course, the style of play which Tottenham then pursued in the second half.
Yeah, I think to be a coach, to be able to make adjustments to the way that you play, you know, Tottenham have really been a build from the back kind of side, play through the thirds and try and play patient attacking football. But then they bring on Llorente because of Ajax's clear weakness at centre-half in David Blind, you know, a player who struggled in England with physical play. And it was the third goal comes from a long diagonal, hopeful ball forward from Sissoko. Llorente wins the first one against De Ligt, and then they pick up second balls, which is a much more difficult way to play when you have so many technical players at Tottenham. And what was really fascinating and interesting for me was the fact that every player bought into that strategy and way of playing in order to get the best for the team. It was an absolutely amazing thing to watch.
It was a bit like watching Graham Taylor's teams from the 1980s. Yeah. Like, can we not knock it?
Yeah.
Which is something you just don't associate with Tottenham Hotspur.
No, you don't. But you have to use every weakness available in the opposition to win games of football. You know, Jose Mourinho is a massive exponent of that. You know, I remember when Manchester United played Ajax and Manchester United gave up nearly 80% of possession to win the game. You know, sometimes to win games of football, you have to go away from the original way of playing. And Pochettino again showed what a masterclass of a tactician he is. I thought it was very fascinating from the first game. You know, he made a clear mistake in setting up with a back five, changed it at half time, was more direct even in the first leg. And without scoring the goal, they had a few chances from that. And it came to bear fruit last night. On Wednesday night, an incredible game.
Duncan, you were kind of slightly confused by De Ligt's performance, weren't you?
Not confused. I thought it was interesting to watch him in that situation. I watched him in the Champions League this year. He looks exactly the kind of player that's being described to me by top scouts as, you know, this is a future top centre-back in the world in all areas of the game, except when he's been confronted with those long balls down the middle. And as Liam just noted, the third goal came from De Ligt kind of being muscled off the ball by Llorente and allowing him to get that first header in. I think he struggled in the first leg as well when Pochettino changed to go direct. It's interesting because he has the physique and he has that aerial presence attacking set pieces, certainly offensively, and I think defensively too. He's pretty good on defensive set pieces. Ball down the middle, which makes you think if you're his representative, whether you'd advise against a move to England when you've got so many big clubs interested in him, or whether you'd say actually go to England because then you can round out that part of your game and you know, turn yourself into the complete centre back while you're still a teenager or in your very early 20s. So interesting to know what Liam's view of that would be.
Yeah, no, I think for any young centre-half, it's a learning experience. I think De Ligt is an absolutely incredible athlete for his age. I think he's someone who's going to mature and grow. He's fantastic in possession. But lessons, I think Glenn Hoddle rightly said, the lessons that those Ajax players would have made from last night and taken forward in their careers would be absolutely huge. And one thing I think about the key of being a centre-half, albeit a young centre-half, is managing your line and managing your back four. And when you're dealing with long balls up to Llorente, you need to make sure that your line's not too deep to begin with, because then Llorente can back into you and use his physical strength. If De Ligt was maybe 4 or 5 years old with more experience, he would have marshalled his back four. And that's where Daley Blind, who for me is not a natural centre-half, they needed someone who was going to keep the line high and then be brave in dealing with that long aerial threat that Tottenham possessed in the second half.
Duncan, we talked a lot and a lot of people have made comments, especially Tottenham Hotspur fans, this season about the fact that they didn't sign any players in either of the windows eligible for this season. Does reaching the Champions League final vindicate Daniel Levy's policy?
Well, I don't think it vindicates Daniel Levy's policy, because if you ask Maurizio Pochettino whether he was happy with that strategy of addressing the season, I think you'll see his answer in, well, not quite every press conference after they've had poor results this season, but pretty much most of them. You know, he's made it very clear that they need more investment, they need stronger players. I think taking these two games where they've got through on away goals as vindication that the squad's in the right place when they've lost so many games in the Premier League recently and fell away from Premier League contention because of that would be strange. They beat Manchester City, yes, but we've talked on this podcast a number of times about how poor Pep Guardiola's record is in knockout Champions League games, particularly with Manchester City. You know, they're only having beaten Schalke and one other very weak side in the 3 years he's been at Manchester City so far. So they were a team who were available to get a tactical result against, as he did in that game. And then to beat Ajax, I mean, Ajax, sensational quality in their squad. And I think a real shame for football that we won't see this team in a Champions League final, because this was the only chance they had to get there. I think it's an indication also of what we talk about in the Champions League a lot, small margins making a difference. You've got, you know, things like Ziyech's shot in the last 10 minutes coming off the post instead of going in. And also that kind of maturity that Liam's talking about there, De Ligt not being able to lead the line because he's young and he doesn't have that experience. So the decision-making, knowing how to get through those situations and games. I think one thing that was very noticeable to me was that in that second half, when Tottenham rattled them, Ajax's goalkeeper started hitting the ball from hand long to the opposition as soon as he got it, which is completely contrary to the way Ajax normally play, and was essentially saying, giving the ball straight back to Tottenham, because I think probably 75-80% of those long balls were gathered by Tottenham players, played back up to Llorente, and immediately put them back in trouble. So that lack of experience counted against Ajax. And then if you're going the underdog line, you've got to note that Tottenham's wage bill was more than three times Ajax's, you know, £148 million last year pounds against Ajax's £53 million, and that their wage bill is almost twice Ajax's entire revenue as a club. So that was a game that Tottenham should have won. And I think I quite like Christian Eriksen's very honest comments after the match, where, you know, talking about it being a ridiculous game and saying that Ajax played the better football over the two games, and essentially they were lucky to get through, but they got through because they didn't want to have the embarrassment of being, you know, badly beaten at half time. That's obviously great credit to Pochettino, not just in the tactical change, but in getting his players to respond in that second half and fighting and working for those breaks. And they got the break in the final seconds of the game and went through.
And Liam, it's interesting, I think, that apparently Pochettino's half time talk was really quite short and concise. Harry Kane was actually the man who went in as captain and was shouting at his teammates and saying, what are we doing here? This is ridiculous, etc. Apparently, Pochettino simply said, if we score one goal, we're back in this game. Go out and get me a goal. And can something as simple as that, as a coach, turn the tide?
Yeah, it can. It's all about timing for me. And I think key leadership is allowing and delegating to really important people within your squad. And obviously, Harry Kane as a player is influential in that dressing room. And yeah, I think you see it more and more in the modern game. You know, I think in years gone by, it was always the manager's message that was the most important. But when you delegate now, you give power and accountability to players. And what that does, it creates an atmosphere where they need to go out and do it themselves. And I've always felt there was an air of vulnerability with Ajax in the youth in their side and the lack of experience and not being in that situation, the Champions League. And you could see, you know, they scored two goals in 4 minutes. Moura scores two goals. As soon as the first goal goes in, the atmosphere at the stadium becomes nervous and tense. And as Duncan's rightly said, as soon as that first goal in as well, Ajax just started conceding possession because they weren't in a comfortable place anymore. And that's a true test of a player. It's not when things are going well. Can you take the ball and be brave when you're under pressure and you have to hold on to a game?
It's been proposed, Duncan, that from next season, away goals may well be abolished in these competitions. Would you say that Liverpool's dramatic win against Barcelona and obviously Tottenham's dramatic win against Ajax are state a very good case for why they should be reinstated, well, not reinstated, but kept in the game in order to make these games just as exciting as we've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had two of the most dramatic, entertaining Champions League semi-finals we've ever seen. And you know, the Tottenham game in particular, I think Tottenham were ahead in that match for, I think it was 159 seconds of the entire two legs. And they went from being behind and out to going through on one goal. And it was on a knife edge because the away goals mean so much in these matches. It turns a game, instead of turning games from wins into draws, they turn games from wins into defeats. And that for me makes these games so dramatic, makes them be played in a different fashion. The tactics are changed because of them. And I think, interestingly, because we're going into an all-English European final, which I don't think that will be necessarily as good to watch as the Man City Tottenham, Liverpool Man City from last season ties, because I think those games have been more exciting, and I've heard commentators talk about how they feel different from Premier League matches. I think it's exactly because of the away goal rule changes the dynamic of the match, and to throw that away would be a huge mistake, because there, for me, there's no question that the Champions League is not just the best technical, tactical football we can watch. It's also the most entertaining and dramatic when it gets into these knockout stages, and you mess around with that format at your peril.
Liam, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the away goals rule is what makes the Champions League so exciting. It gives coaches different problems in terms of, do you attack a game at home or do you try and stop goals? And it keeps the ties so level. You know, I love the away goals rule because it just creates so much uncertainty. The momentum shifts in these two-legged games are absolutely incredible. So hopefully they stick with the away goals rule, because as well, it encourages away teams to attack, which means you have far more open games of football, which is what the neutral observer wants to see. You know, if you look at the aggregate scores of the last two games, semi-finals, lots of goals, lots of excitement, lots of drama. I think taking away that away goals rule allows a team away from home to sit back and rely on their home form in the first or second leg.
And of course, the same scenario last season when Roma went out on, as Roma went through on away goals, beating Barcelona, having lost 4-1, I think, in Camp Nou, and then won 3-0 in the second leg in Stadio Olimpico. So clearly there is a pattern here where away goals have been very significant. And personally, I'm really disappointed that they dropped the toss of the coin and replaced it with the penalty shootout. I think that's, you know, that was much more exciting. So,
I
was speaking to a friend of mine who works for UEFA this morning and is in Neon, UEFA's headquarters this morning. And I was told that there's a mood of depression about the fact it's an all-English final, because they feel like it makes the final, which of course is the UEFA showpiece event in club football, less interesting to the rest of the world and more interesting simply to the UK and in particular England, obviously. Obviously, we've had quite a lot of representatives and successes in both Europa League over the last 5 years. Obviously, Liverpool reached the Champions League final last season as well as this season. Is it too early to talk of English domination, Liam, in European football?
I think it's a great time for English football, the Premier League in general. And I think the coaches have contributed so much to that. If you look at Guardiola, Klopp, Pochettino, they're bringing a style of football, an exciting style of play. And especially in Pochettino's case, with the budget that he's had to work with, they are making our Premier League so strong at the top level. And you can see it in the points totals now of the two top teams. You know, they're miles away. For me, the two best sides in Europe, and in Tottenham have had to up their game and their levels to stay with them. So I think it's a great period for English football. And at the moment, you can see, especially in the Champions League, that our teams are now really flying the flag for the whole of European football, which is absolutely brilliant from my point of view.
Duncan, are you a bit depressed by an all-English final?
Well, as I just said, I think I'm with that Neon UEFA argument that it's not quite as interesting to have an English final between teams who play each other on a regular basis. I would love to have seen Ajax in the final. I think it would have been great for football to have a team built on such a small budget with such young players, with, you know, a club that had said, this is the only way we can compete on the European stage is to accelerate our youth development project, sell our players earlier, bring our good youth talents into the team quicker, and then be canny on a couple of transfers per season, bringing, you know, guys like Tadic and Daley Blind. I agree with Liam. I think Daley Blind was found out a bit against Tottenham. this week, but I think he's turned out to be a much better signing for Ajax. I was surprised when they paid so much money for him in the summer, but I think I now understand why they did it. But it would have been fantastic to see that strategy and a small budget club from a small country get to a Champions League final. With really the only opportunity we'll have to see that team together, particularly at a time when you've got a number of the biggest clubs in European football, led by Juventus, Andrea Agnelli, pushing for a European Super League and trying to aggressively limit the access of as many clubs to that European Super League as possible, and trying to take more and more of the game's revenue into the big clubs' hands. So it would have been a nice slap in the face, I think, if Ajax had got there. The English football, is it going to be dominant? Well, you have to say that at youth level, their teams are better than they've been, I think, ever. I think the record of youth competition, international results is unsurpassed as far as English football is concerned. And I think that's the real interesting side, is to see how many of those players can get into Premier League teams and become dominant there. Because when we talk about English dominance in the Champions League at present, we're talking about teams that are all led by foreign coaches. And I mean, just going through the two semi-final second legs in the Champions League, and there's just six English players started for the two teams, three of whom were fullbacks. And we all know here that fullbacks are the least important players on the pitch, don't we?
Oh, harsh. Look, as a Champions League final, what do we think, guys? I mean, is there a favourite in this? Liam, do you think there's one team's favoured over the other?
I think if you're talking about preferences before, who Liverpool would have preferred to face, I think they would have preferred to face Ajax. I think Ajax would have suited Liverpool's quick counter-attack and play, their speed of play. I don't think Ajax would have been able to deal with the intensity. In terms of Tottenham, you have a team who know Liverpool so well. Pochettino has played against Klopp's team so many times. So I think it makes it a lot closer. But for me, Liverpool will still be favourites. They're the better side overall. But I just think that they would much have preferred to have Ajax in the final than face a familiar foe in Tottenham.
And Duncan, interesting that you could arguably say that both Tottenham and Liverpool qualified for the final in the absence of their best player. Is it sometimes an advantage not to have the likes of Kane and Salah in your team, because they are so significant in terms of that formation and the way that team plays, its philosophy? People defer, I say teammates, defer possession to that player probably more often than they should. And almost it's the case, I think I saw anyway, especially in Liverpool's defeat of Barcelona, that possession was deferred much more equally to other players.
I think in Tottenham's case, given the way that they beat Ajax, which was through those direct balls and aerial dominance, I think having Harry Kane in would have been better for them, because they could have played the same way, the same type of balls, and then also had Kane's additional mobility and quality in the ball. So I don't think it was a disadvantage for them. Liverpool, yeah, I agree. I think Liverpool did a fantastic job in that second leg, but I think they only really had one way of going at that game, being 3-0 down, being without Salah and Firmino. Okay, they had an option. They could have played Sturridge at centre forward, but they decided to go for Origi. So they essentially had to go as high tempo, as high press, as aggressive as possible, as direct on the Barcelona defence as they could, which you saw them do. I mean, you saw from the very first minute of the game, they were flying into tackles. You got Fabinho basically flying into a two-footed tackle to stop Messi on the edge of the box as Robertson sandwiches him on the other side. The referee doesn't give a foul, and then Robertson has a go at Messi, slaps him in the back of the head, accusing him of diving for it. And Klopp, I think he did what he had to do, and I think this is an interesting side of the Champions League for me, is that UEFA have clearly instructed the referees to be more like Premier League referees. It used to be that there was a big divergence in the refereeing In European competition and English competition. But UEFA have obviously said to the referees, we like this high tempo tolerance of aggressive tackling. It makes for good television. So work that way. And Liverpool were always going to be better at that than Barcelona. And they went right on the edge of it a number of occasions. I mean, I've seen Liverpool supporters putting videos up of Jordan Henderson flying 2 feet off the ground into a tackle onto Sergio Roberto, where he does just manage to get the ball first, but then goes straight through the player's planted leg. And only because Roberto had the skill to get out of it does he end up not getting injured, and, you know, lionizing him for that behaviour. I mean, in 5 years ago in the Champions League, that challenge could have been a red card, because Henderson is out of control and endangering his opponent. In this case, the referee did nothing. Henderson went through that game without being booked. So they did. The setup of the team was great. They played to what they had. Klopp, as Jose Mourinho commented in his analysis of the match for beIN Sports, has to take immense credit for the way he motivated that team and got them to believe that they could get through a situation where I thought they had no chance of winning that match. I think they still had to, they had to have an exceptional performance from the goalkeeper. They had to have Messi on a night where he had, you know, three chances to kill the tie in the first half, missed all of them. But, you know, if when you're 3-0 down from the first leg, you really don't have many options available to you. And I think there is a bit something to be said for your argument that not having Salah there added to the way they had to play and the way they got the first goal and the way they carried on throughout the match with, you know, lesser storied players stepping up and coming up with incredible performances to beat the favourites for the tournament.
As a player, Liam, does over-familiarity with your opponent, what effect does that have on a game like a Champions League final? Because obviously these two teams have met many times already, same personnel, same coaches, et cetera, et cetera. I think one of the reasons that we've had such incredible semi-finals is because the clubs are not used to playing against each other, and therefore there's that element of the unknown. But I'm afraid personally that we're going to get quite a kind of, you know, stilted, cautious, you know, not no one wants to lose this game type final, which you often find when you get two teams who are very familiar with each other.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think when you play against a team that you're used to playing in your own domestic league, you have such an understanding of the way that they want to play, and you find in the end, you find two teams that can actually cancel each other out. The only saving grace for me in terms of that is I think the philosophies of both Pochettino and Klopp is to go and win games in football. I think even in the games we've seen between them this season, we've seen very tight affairs, but very exciting games as well. Now, I don't think either manager will go too far away from his overall philosophy, which for me is attacking the game, pressing the ball high up the pitch and scoring goals. So I do think it'll be an interesting watch, and I think it'll be still a fun game to watch just because of the way that the two teams play.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think the games we've seen between Liverpool and Tottenham this season have been good, and they've also got a lot of recovery time both sides before the final, which I think is a plus. So we should have teams in the best physical condition they can be at this stage of the season.
So from Liverpool's glorious Champions League progression to Premier League contention, what's going to happen on the final day this coming Sunday? Thankfully, we have a man very, very much connected with one of those clubs who have got a say in what's going to happen in the Premier League title race. Liam, you're obviously around the club every day in your position as coach of the under-23s, and obviously Manchester City are visitors to the Amex on Sunday afternoon, needing to win to guarantee the title. What's the mood around Brighton? Is there a kind of feeling of we do have an opportunity to make a massive influence here? Or are we looking at a club who are still celebrating their own survival?
I think the overriding word to be worth at Brighton is relief and excitement about moving forward. You know, we've been under a cloud for the last few months in terms of our own form, terms of maybe being relegated. Obviously, that's been lifted now with Crystal Palace winning and us getting a really good draw away at Arsenal. And one thing I'll say is Pep Guardiola will be very aware that in Brighton, you have a team that really love to defend their box. And if you watch the semi-final in the FA Cup, Brighton came very close to getting a draw in that game. So it's not going to be easy for Manchester City by any means. They're obviously in the driving seat. But I just think in terms of us at Brighton, there's absolutely no pressure on the game. It's an absolutely amazing occasion to be a part of. And I know the lads will give it absolutely everything to do their best on a professional level. And I think that's what you can ask for.
Do you think that there's an extra pressure on Brighton in terms of being in that position, Liam, is quite unusual, isn't it? Where you've got effectively nothing to play for, but at the same time, you're let's just say, you've got to play for the integrity of the competition.
Yeah.
By not just simply turning up. And so there is a pressure on Brighton to do that because they will come under criticism if City run out easy winners.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's being a professional. Any game you play and you want to give your best, you know. And I think it's actually a very, very good time for us to have a game like this where we've been under a cloud for a long time. You know, performances haven't been great. Form hasn't been great. All of a sudden, that pressure of relegation is lifted. And the players can go out and know without pressure they can go and express themselves against, for me, what are the best club team in Europe at the moment. I know they haven't made the Champions League final, but in terms of their form, you know, any other year Liverpool would have walked home with that trophy a long time ago. But they can just go express themselves and test themselves against the best. And if you do that, no matter what the result is, that's all you can ask for.
And as a player, is it quite fun to actually know that you can be a little part of history in terms of, say, preventing Manchester City from winning the title and being part of a team who contributed to Liverpool's first title in 29 years?
100%. These are the games as a professional I always wanted to be a part of. You know, you want to be able to go and test yourself at a very, very high level game. In terms of the coverage, I think the whole world could be watching. You don't want to let yourself down in situations like that. And I know every player, from a Brighton point of view, all want to give the best account of themselves for personal reasons, for team reasons. And that makes it really incredible viewing on Sunday. I don't think it's going to be a straight foot, especially if Liverpool score early in their game. Manchester City will know they're moving ball and it'll make it a really nervy occasion for them. I'm sure that's what Brighton will be looking to do.
Liam, you had a long career. Were you ever in a situation like this where it didn't matter to your team, in particular what the result would be in a game, but it was a match where if you won, you could destroy the chances of the opposition to win a title or get promotion?
I can remember a few occasions like that. The biggest occasion I can remember in terms of integrity of the game, I played in a Fulham team that needed to win against Liverpool, Rafa Benitez's Liverpool, to stay up. And Rafa completely changed his team. He almost played a youth team, and we won 1-0. I think it was before the Istanbul final when Liverpool went on to win. And he completely changed the team, and we at Fulham went on to win 1-0. And it meant Sheffield United got relegated. And Neil Warnock actually wanted to sue Liverpool for putting out the team that Rafa did. Now, for me, a manager's job is to do the best for his own club. You cannot worry about other results. It's a 38 game season. And in that instance, Rafa was proven to be right in the team that he selected. That amazing comeback and the energy levels Liverpool showed in the second half. So that's the biggest one I've been involved in where the integrity of a game's been thrown into question. But all you can do at the 38 games is concentrate on yourself. I don't think you can rely on others to get your result.
Yeah, that's a different situation, isn't it? Because as you say, Rafa had the key... Exactly. Game for his team to look after and was concerned with that. How long did the celebrations go on for at Brighton after the team stayed up last week?
I don't think there were so much celebrations. I wouldn't say it was a celebratory mood. I think it was more of a relief. I think, yes, it's a great achievement in the second season to stay up. But I think in terms of our performances this season, we know we've got a lot to improve on. So I don't think it's a time to be celebrating, more a time to regather and take a breath, be excited for what's to come, and remember the lessons that we've learned from this season in terms of a lot of things, you know, the way we play, the types of players we recruited for the squad. I think a lot of lessons will be learned in the long term from our point of view.
So I was speaking to one Brighton player who obviously shall remain nameless, guys, and I've put the kind of proposition to him that if he scored a winning goal against Manchester City, then he would be Liverpool's player of the year. to which he replied, but I'm a Manchester United fan.
Yeah.
So figure out who it is, if you like. What are our predictions then, please, guys? I can't let this go, given the enormity of what's happening this weekend. Who do we think is going to win the league? And what do we think the scores are going to be in those two key games? Duncan, you first.
Oh, you've got to make the Brighton expert go first.
Are you planning to contradict him? Is that why?
you know I always do.
Yeah.
Go on then, Liam, you go first.
I think if I'm a betting man, I think both the teams win. You know, I'm obviously a Brighton man, but the quality that Manchester City possess, it's going to be a very, very tall order to keep them out for 90 minutes. But I do think it'll be tight. I don't think Manchester City will run away 3-4 goal winners. I think it'll be by the odd goal, maybe two. But I do think Manchester City will end up winning the title.
Duncan?
Yeah, I agree. I can't see Manchester City having done what they've done in the second half of the season and chasing down that large Liverpool lead, barely conceding a goal in the last few months in the Premier League, letting it slip in this match. But if they don't score early, I think I absolutely see what Liam's talking about, the tight game, a difficult game. And, you know, we saw the nervousness in their performance on Monday night, and you could see that again. But I would say City to win, maybe 2-0. And then Liverpool, I think the integrity argument and the ability to cause pain to a team that are desperate for a win to try and secure the title applies in spades to Wolves, because they know they're good enough to get a result against Liverpool. And I think quite a few on that team would enjoy rubbing it in their faces. So I don't see that one being an easy game, particularly if Wolves take one, manage to score a goal early on the counter-attack. So I think I'll go for Liverpool to win that, but also a very tight result there.
Well, I think after the fairy tale of Anfield on Tuesday, Liverpool players probably do believe in miracles. And so you never know. It's going to be one of those nail-biting ones, isn't it, where everyone's on their radios and their smartphones trying to see what's happening in the other team's game. And I think it's going to be a really brilliant, brilliant Sunday for everyone watching, because as the drama unfolds, it's going to be very exciting. Just as exciting as the legendary quickfire round, which closes this particular Transfer Window podcast. And we're going for something a bit different today, people, because having been inspired by seeing the Stonehenge monolith-like lack of emotion James Milner, by reputation, in tears on the pitch at the end of the game on Tuesday night when they beat Barcelona to go through to the Champions League final. And then seeing Mauricio Pochettino, a man, of course, not noted for his emotions either, crying for probably 45 minutes through every interview, on pitch, in press conference, after press conference, mix zone. We want to see who we think is the biggest crybaby in football. I'm going to go to Liam first on this one, because this is a man, remember, there's been many a dressing room where there's been exaltation as well as destitution, and he must have seen a few people cry who you never expected. Liam, yeah, give us your answer.
The one I remember the most was a big centre-half, Abdoulaye Faye. He played for Newcastle, Bolton, big, strong, as macho as you can get. And I remember at Hull, we were 10 minutes away from being promoted. He gave a penalty away, which Cardiff scored. And we had to wait for the result and Leeds to come in to see if we were getting promoted. But in the meantime, he went and locked himself in a bathroom, and you could hear him through the dressing room, through the corridor, bawling his eyes out, and he just locked himself in. No one could get in to console him. And it was one of the most striking memories of someone crying in football and the emotions that it brings.
That's quite moving, actually, Liam.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Here's me trying to be a bit jokey about it, and you've told us a story where we're all crying.
Yeah, no, that's the amazing thing about football. It evokes emotions that, you know, you can't describe, whether you're a supporter, a player, even a neutral, who's watched the two games in the Champions League this week. I just think it's an incredible sport that brings out the best in people. It brings out vulnerability in people. And that was the best example I could give for my career.
And can we ask you, have you ever cried about football match?
Oh, so many times. Missing out on the effort in the FA Cup final, having to walk past the trophy. I bawled like a baby. But it was a great experience. And when you get those extreme emotions, they're a wonderful thing to wonderful memories to treasure, whether it's a negative or a positive in the end.
And now we pass the mic, as it were, to one of football's biggest cynics, the great Dr. Duncan Castles, who we wholly expect to give us an answer which will make us both laugh and probably cry with laughter.
I have to say, I would never have expected Abdul Ifai to be the guy that Liam picked out. That's a great story. My biggest memory of a football player crying would have to be the last time we had an All-English Champions League final. And we had that moment when John Terry decided to break the pre-decided penalty kick order against Manchester United, because he had the opportunity to take the penalty that would win the Champions League for the first time for Chelsea. And as we all remember, slipped on the turf and sent it wide of the post, and Manchester United turned the game around. And there are those famous pictures of John Terry in tears in the Moscow rain as he walked off the pitch. And one of the reasons that strike comes to mind is I remember having a conversation after the match in Moscow in the stadium about what had happened. And you remember that was the season where Jose Mourinho was sacked as Chelsea manager. And one of the individuals who was instrumental in his dismissal was John Terry. And obviously there was a significant amount of bad blood between the two going forward. And the conversation after the game, we talked about what happened to Terry. And the comment was, yes, God put the European Cup before his eyes and he took it away from him. If you're talking about emotions in football, I think that sums up some of the strong emotions and the conflicts that can happen in the game. That for me is the real memory of, or the one that came to mind when you asked about crying footballers.
I think the phrase is karma, Duncan, that you're searching for there in terms of Mr. Mourinho. Indeed. Of course, John Terry did go on to enjoy Champions League success with Chelsea in 2012 when he didn't play but did appear on the pitch wearing his shin guards for the celebrations. So maybe his tears then were just about the fact that his shin guards were a bit kicked. So with that, people, it's time to draw this particular episode of the Transfer Window podcast shut. We are very grateful for your participation. Therefore, if you want to continue the debate, and we'd love to hear about your versions of the biggest crybabies in football, if you want to contact us, you can do so on our own Transfer Podcast at Transfer Podcast account on Twitter. Duncan is at Duncan Castles. And Liam, would you like to tell everyone your own Twitter handle, please?
Yep, it's at Rosinia_Liam23.
See, it's even less complicated than mine, which is at GarboSJ, as you all know, because you always ask me what it means. If you liked what you heard, and thousands of you do, please return the favour and give something back and go onto iTunes, give us a 5-star review. That helps us to increase the community who enjoy this podcast 3 times a week. And remember, we will be back next week to satisfy all your podcasting needs on Monday, Wednesday and Friday. Until then, we wish you goodbye. We wish you to enjoy what will be an incredible weekend, certainly Sunday of football in terms of the climax of the Premier League. And we shall be talking about that on Monday. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.